Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. You can download our 2024 sponsor kit on our homepage at onstrategyshowcase.com. Next week, we launch the first episode in our CFO-CMO series, sponsored by Analytic Partners, the leader in commercial analytics. For some, these are roles that speak different languages and have conflicting goals, while others have learned a common language and approach that makes working together far more successful. We'll be joined for episode one in this series by Johnny Cahill, CMO, and Tim Bodart, CFO of Heineken USA, to talk about the dynamics of their working relationship. Today, we have episode number three in our three-part series titled Startups, Scale-Ups, and Grown-Ups. We're focusing on the role of marketing, the marketing mix, and the role of brand in growth. Here's a clip from today's show.
We will always continue to follow consumption. So you just have to be where your audiences are. And certainly, we already talked a little bit about the power and value of unexpected actions that lead to earned media and PR. So that's an important part of our mix. But, you know, broad-based advertising and marketing works. And frankly, it is more cost-effective, you know, cost per point. When you get really, really segmented, you're paying more. So when you're a brand as big as we are, broad-based media certainly works. I think the two areas that get really interesting and have shifted so much in the last few years is just the creator economy and influencers, and how to do that in a way that makes sense, is relevant, and is authentic, and really authentic to your brand. And find creators that really love Domino's tend to do that the best. And then I think partnerships. I think that is not something Domino's has historically done a tremendous amount of work, but when you're a bigger brand, you're more mature, and there's other brands that have, there's just that mutual benefit of sharing your equity and what can neither of us do on our own that only we can do together. I think that's a huge unlock that we're looking to take advantage more of in the future.
That's Kate Trumbull, SVP, Chief Brand Officer at Domino's Pizza. She's joined by Stephanie Jacoby, Global SVP, Smirnoff Vodka at Diageo, and Heather Malinshek, SVP and CMO at Lando Lakes. We talk about the way mature brands achieve incremental growth and how they defend against early stage challengers. And we'll hear about the advantages of being a grown up and the ways budgets and channel spend are being deployed differently. I'm joined for the intro to this last episode in this series by Connor Archbold, co-founder and CEO of this series sponsor, Tracksuit, the affordable brand tracking system for modern day brands. Welcome, Connor.
Thanks, Fergus. Happy to be here.
So in this episode, we're going to hear about mature brands and the fact that they can become vulnerable to sort of non-traditional or unexpected competitors. So I'm curious, from a brand tracking platform point of view, how can you balance being a legacy brand and dealing with up-and-coming brands and challenger brands?
The first thing to note is just what an advantage that legacy brands have over new brands in so many ways, just because it takes a long time to build awareness, consideration, and preference. So, I think they have so much strength just in the fact that they are a legacy brand. They can be a bit more patient, even if there are challengers. Microsoft Teams Slack example, I would say for years, people thought that, you know, Teams and Microsoft would have been behind the eight ball in terms of launching a corporate chat. Slack were dominating, it seemed, and then within months of launching Teams, Microsoft overtook Slack in terms of, you know, monthly active users. Taking your time, being a fast follower in a space, and using and leveraging your huge brand and legacy status, you know, it can be an advantage in that you get to watch what's happening in the market and then react to it.
What's the advantage from a brand tracking perspective in terms of how to figure out how to leverage these strengths and how to leverage these or reframe these vulnerabilities? How can tracking help you do that?
One of the really interesting things for legacy brands about tracking is that you get to understand the whole category. So you're in there, you've got 70, 80% awareness. how people think and feel about your brand isn't changing too much. You are using tracking to make sure that nothing is going off the rails. You are also using tracking to see like how the category is changing. Is the category growing? If you're a legacy brand in the alcohol category, you've been looking at the non-alcohol category and being like, oh my God, look at that. That is growing insanely. We need to be in there. We need to launch products. And that's helping legacy brands launch products in new categories. You're understanding what people like about those new companies. And if that feels like something you could own by, you know, being a fast follower, copying well, and launching in that space.
Thanks, Connor. It is Connor Archbold, co-founder and CEO of Tracksuit. You can learn more about Tracksuit at gotracksuit.com. Now, here's episode 3, Mature Brands. Enjoy. Let me start off first with Kate. Tell us about what the key marketing challenges are in your category today. We've had the pleasure, by the way, of having your agency on, and we've talked about all of the brilliant work you've done. And so I'm super excited to talk to you directly about this. You're in a category, I don't know how you can define how you want to define it, but it's got some challenges, right, that you're faced with on a daily basis.
Yeah, Fergus, absolutely. And I think probably every industry has their own challenges. I think, you know, as far as the QSR, the quick service restaurant industry, certainly now inflation is a big part of the challenge, right? Consumers are under tremendous pressure. Prices have increased. Food costs has increased. Labor has increased. And, you know, that creates challenges in how you manage through profitability, passing along price, but still also providing meaningful value to your consumer. And I think the bigger backdrop there is QSR has also never been larger or more fragmented or more accessible, right? You think about third-party Uber Eats, DoorDash, you can get anything you want at any time. That just wasn't the case even 10 years ago. So, and pizza as a product is so incredibly universal and so beloved that we also know even QSR players that traditionally haven't played in pizza are trying to get a piece of the pie, right? Whether it's KFC or Panera, Chick-fil-A.
And it's also interesting to point out, Heather, that you guys are a cooperative, farmer-owned cooperative. And for scale, a sense of scale, Land O'Lakes, hope I'm getting this right, is close to a $15 billion company, $15 billion in revenues last year, and 10,000 employees. And this isn't a small dairy farm.
No, it's not. And actually, I think we're closer to 19 billion, but we've had a few really good years. So we are, yes, farmer-owned cooperative. We're actually owned by a mix of dairy farmers, ag retailers, who are those co-ops in the communities that serve the farmer with grain and agronomic expertise, and then also some row crop farmers. So we have different member groups within our portfolio. And I love the idea that we're cooperative. I love it for many reasons, but one of the most compelling reasons for me is that we work on behalf of our farmers. So we have different, I would say we have different profit motives as a cooperative than a C-Corp, a traditional C-Corp. So our success really starts with our member success. So we are in business to help them be successful. When consumers find out that we're farmer owned, that makes a big difference in how they think about us. And then a commodity category, it's really important to be able to sort of make that connection. What I felt like coming into the company just over 3 years ago, now 3.5 years ago, was the power is really in telling the story of the entire enterprise. So we've been doing a lot of work at the corporate level, which is having a nice halo actually across our businesses. So really starting to help people understand the importance of where our food comes from, and then the role that each business plays in the food ecosystem.
So Stephanie, vodka, Smirnoff Vodka, it's been the world's leading brand. It's been around for 100, I think it's the 1800s originally.
Mm-hmm.
1864. And we've had the pleasure of having a dedicated episode to Smirnoff also. Tell us about that. Not only is the spirits category dynamic, but vodka has been arguably one of the most dynamic aspects of the spirits category in the last 5 years or so.
Yeah, it's dynamic both in that vodka's growing as well as all of the ready-to-drinks that are now showing up in cans are over 25% vodka. So we're growing in lots of different directions, and the category is changing. I think Heather or Kate spoke to the fragmentation that's happening in her industry. We see the same. There's big brands like Smirnoff who've been around for over 100 years, but there is lots of craft brands, lots of startups entered into space, and it's just become super competitive, super noisy. And I think for a brand like Smirnoff, you know, we basically created vodka globally. You know, I mean, it's a $40 billion category, and you know, Smirnoff started the vodka renaissance by introducing vodka to the U.S. in the 1930s as the white whiskey. And from there, it's just ballooned into, you know, the largest category by volume in spirits. And we were at the helm of that, which is awesome. And we have this amazing legacy. And I think, as Heather spoke about, you know, talking about the farmers and how motivating that is to consumers, it's really motivating to our consumers to remind them that this is a brand with real heritage, and that we've been around for a long time for a reason, because we're really good quality. Because I think sometimes being one of the biggest brands in the business, with, you know, all of the craft trends, the luxury trends happening, you know, the challenge that we have is we have all the salience, all the awareness, but really kind of continuing to drive that relevance to consumers and really connecting particularly to new generations. So legal drinking age plus, kind of Gen Z consumers being that next emerging generation, is constant work in a category where we're never going to be the newest or the coolest, but being able to be a brand that delivers great quality at a great price, particularly for consumers that are feeling more downward economic pressure than ever.
Kate, for you, Domino's built that business on delivery. It was one of the first, almost a pioneer in doing that. There was this sort of sea change, though, that happened, obviously, with apps. And you guys have done a great job of migrating people onto your app. Has that had an impact on your business in recent years? And how have you begun to address that?
Yeah, I mean, we were founded in 1960. And as you said, pioneers of delivery, and have been innovating ever since around delivery. A couple of things have really happened. To your point, people started to migrate to ordering digitally, and we were really ahead of that, right? And we doubled down on it. Right. We invested. We did things as simple as 50% off weeks to drive more people to with value to order online. And we did innovation. You know, you can tweet your order, things like that. We really focused on being a tech company who happens to sell pizza. And 80% of our sales now come through our digital platform. So it has really transformed the business. What I think is really fascinating, though, is that was our heritage, but what we've seen tremendous growth from in the last several years is carryout, right? We started our whole brand around delivering to you, but we built enough brand love, awareness, value that as consumers make decisions, we started to be in the selection set beyond just delivery. It used to be Domino's, Pizza Hut, and Chinese food that you could order. And now with third-party delivery, it really has changed everything. As you know, we have begun partnering with Uber Eats, and we really see that as an opportunity, again, to be as accessible as we can to consumers. And so for consumers who, you know, are on a channel like Uber Eats, and they, you know, that's their most convenient option, we want to be there, and we want to do that really well. But we still deliver it to those consumers. So we are, it's an ordering platform for us, but we still control and take very seriously that kind of last mile and making sure you get the most hot, delicious product with a really professional experience from our delivery drivers.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because I'm glad you commented on that, because I was thinking, well, what do you do with your own network of drivers that you've built over decades? And that answers it. They will still deliver it, but you'll just take the orders in through Uber Eats.
Exactly.
So I wanted to jump to Heather with the whole organics movement, Heather, in dairy and in other categories and in the crop protection segment. How has that impacted you guys? Has that been a cornerstone of what your offering has always been about?
So we're not really, we don't play in the organic space necessarily. And I think I would suggest it's more of an and, not an or. So our products, we've actually had, I think we're doing better in butter now than we've ever done. We had a record year last year, all set to, well, we started off this year really strong. So the organic movement is there, but it's a little bit like plant-based. It's sort of people are consuming both and not making a choice of one or another. So our business has done nothing but strengthen over the years. It's a beloved brand, and it's something that's associated with key moments in the family. You know, when you think about holidays and things and people baking, and by the way, through COVID, we did extremely well because lots of people were baking. So we did great there. So we have I think it's one of the challenges, like we're a beloved brand. We have very high awareness. Our challenge is really reaching that younger consumer and helping them, bring them into the brand, because we're not necessarily as well known with that Gen Z and younger audience. So that's part of what we're trying to do now, is reach those emerging audiences. And if we talk about our farmer owned story, that really helps people understand why we're different, and you can actually follow the money all the way back to the farm, and that really means a lot for consumers.
For Stephanie, with you guys, mature brand, needs to discover growth, what are some of the ways that you look for that strategically? Are there areas that you look at that are pretty key to achieving it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I love what both Heather and Kate have said, because it just resonates with me so much. And just across, you know, managing these big brands of, like, you know, you have so much latent equity and how much trust consumers put in big brands like ours, which is fantastic. But, you know, as you start to engage emerging generations, you don't have that necessarily that same level of awareness or understanding, or even, like, you know, mistrust of big brands that kind of comes with Gen Z and some younger generations. Unpacking your story and sharing a bit of transparency with these younger consumers is a huge opportunity for growth. I mean, I think for Smirnoff, the parallel is our long-standing commitment to inclusion, you know, which we can date back to advertising in the 1960s that featured Eartha Kitt, who was, of course, a well-known African-American singer at the time. And that's continued to be really core to the DNA of the brand, is this belief that the party is better when everyone is invited. And we really mean everyone. And so I think that's one way that we drive growth, is by being really relevant to the values of this emerging generation. I think also thinking about being a brand in culture. And I think, you know, there's like levels of awareness that you need to drive with a big brand. It's almost like you need to keep kicking that ball up in the air to maintain that. But as I think you've heard, you know, us talk about already, is like that distinctivity and that uniqueness and that point of view is so important to get out into the world.
I was just going to build a little bit on what Stephanie said. And I think that's if there's any sort of secret sauce or magic with brands being around as long as we all have that are still relevant, is really being sort of curious about the cultural conversation and finding an authentic way to join in there. So I think that's one of the reasons that we, you know, what we've been doing lately is telling our broader story, but importantly, you know, getting people to join us on that path to, Stephanie was talking about inclusion, about rural America and how rural America is talked about and viewed, and the rural urban divide, which our company has been a big part of trying to solve for. And we did a lot of work in broadband access, to bring broadband to rural communities. And I think we're tapping into that younger generation. We're really keen to be seen differently, those who live in rural America, which it's really a hotbed for talent. There's a lot of entrepreneurs now in rural America, and there's a lot of values in rural America and communities that are really a model for how we should operate. So we talk a lot about that, which isn't about butter, and it's not about crop inputs, it's not about animal nutrition, but it's a message that's really resonating with a new audience and bringing them into our portfolio, which is great.
Is that a recognition of the fact that most of your market is in that rural segment in terms of who's buying the product now? Because that rural-urban divide has become such a polarizing factor almost in all aspects of society, and it's almost creating an us versus them sort of dynamic.
our business comes from everywhere. I think the important thing that we're trying to see is trying to build the awareness of the interconnectedness that there is. To your point, Fergus, like we talk about the rural urban divide all the time, and to the point where nobody questions it anymore, it just is. And so we're trying to actually bring to light the interconnectedness between urban and rural communities, and importantly, to show the value of rural communities to putting food on our table, because 87% of our food actually comes from those rural communities. So that's why we're trying to support them. It's very important for our food security, which we believe is national security. And the more that we can support those rural communities and lift them up and show urban communities how important they are and how alike they are, hopefully we can, you know, get away from some of this divisive conversation that happens.
I wanted to go back to Stephanie, because what's really interesting, you talked a lot about product innovation as being a way to growth, but is there also sort of looking at target audiences as a way to get incremental growth? And because, I mean, if you look at vodka for the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, maybe more than that, it's been sort of a category of kind of super premium vodkas where, you know, for Smirnoff, it's not only popular, but it's also affordable. So does that, again, I know that language has been used in some marketing materials. Is that a way to sort of carve out a certain type of audience, somebody who can't afford those premiums, but they can afford a Smirnoff as a quality product?
Absolutely. I think on Smirnoff, you know, we believe so firmly in that everybody deserves quality. Everybody should get to enjoy delicious, high-quality cocktails. And so I think that commitment to quality and democratization of quality is at the core of the brand. And I think there's a huge number of consumers that speaks to, but particularly the emerging Gen Z consumers who have, you know, significant economic burdens, you know, many of them still living at home, many of them paying off college debt, et cetera, that even more than other generations, they are feeling the pain of the current economic situation that we find ourselves in. Yet they are also the generation that is most looking for more connectedness and more joy. And I think, you know, the very best version of what we do at Smirnoff is we connect people in meaningful ways in real life over delicious drinks. And so there feels like there's a really meaningful role for us to play in bringing that little bit of joy and greater connection to their lives.
But that's sort of a category benefit, no?
It is a category benefit. However, I think that, again, as the biggest brand in the category with a fantastic quality story, and I think that nostalgia that Kate spoke to, it's a great opportunity for us to just shore up that idea of we're a quality vodka at a great price. And nobody else in the category does that as well as we do.
There's a couple of lines I love from this, the work that you guys have done. One is exclusively for everyone.
Yeah.
Which I thought is a great line. And another one is, this isn't used in marketing communications, but it's a counterbalance to pretension. I always love that line from what came out of some of the earlier interviews.
Exactly. I mean, because sometimes, you know, I mean, spirits, one of the things that's so fun about it is it's a lifestyle category, right? But sometimes it can get pretentious. It can be.
Oh, it is. It's completely pretentious.
Extremely exclusive. And like to the point that it's almost like syrup is the emotional relief to a lot of that pretension and that exclusivity of just like, again, a great brand at a great price, everyone is invited in.
So Kate, when you look at Domino's has been, you know, it's been thought of as been pizza. There's definitely product innovations, but where else do you look for growth?
I think the biggest opportunity for growth in a category like ours is through new channels and service methods. So you think about, I mentioned earlier, you know, so much of our business with delivery. We started to tip our toe into carryout and have seen massive growth there. And we're sourcing outside the pizza category for that growth. We try to take action as a brand that's meaningful and incredibly unexpected. And when you have a creative North Star and filter that way, you tend to take action that, you know, just creates a ton of conversation and media coverage. And I think of things like paving for pizza. No one saw that coming, but it was something we really did. And even emergency pizza in Q4, really, I think we had over 2.6 billion earned media impressions. And it just got so many conversations going. It is not just about what you do. It's how you do it and how you stay really on top of what are those relevant tensions in culture.
Is your growth in terms of locations saturated? I mean, is part of this in terms of getting growth, is it more marketing investment? Is it more locations? So you have greater penetration?
We still have opportunity to grow locations in the U.S. and certainly globally. We're in 90 plus countries, but even in the U.S., there's opportunity. And what we've seen is our carryout business has grown. There's just so much opportunity in terms of where you're located, the visibility of the location. That's still a growth lever for us. Certainly, it was definitely a bigger growth lever 10, 20, 30 years ago, but it's exciting because we still see opportunity in that sort of distribution.
Do you think of your competitor as another pizza? Is it the greater food category? I mean, how do you think about it? Or do you think about it in that way?
Yeah, for innovation, I really think about the QSR category. I think our carryout business is less than 2% share of that whole QSR world. And So it's just, it is massive, the upside. But certainly, what are we tracking and looking at? We look at the major pizza players. We look at regional and local brands. And we certainly look at, you know, our opportunity and fair share on the third-party platforms. And like I said, I think we run two different businesses. We have a delivery business and we have a carryout business. And I do think the carryout side of the business, it's even more upside in that broader QSR space.
We'll be right back. This series is brought to you by Tracksuit, a beautiful, affordable, and always-on brand tracking tool that helps you answer the question, is what we're doing working? A not-so-secret fact is that companies pay $100,000 or more for brand tracking, which is out of the question for modern brands whose budgets are under pressure. Tracksuit has been built by marketers for marketers and makes brand tracking 10 times easier and 10 times more affordable. Their research experts do the heavy lifting by using best-in-class practices to craft the questions and get your survey live. Tracksuit surveys thousands of people each week from panels of millions around the world to give you full visibility of your brand health in 30 days, with insights updated for your brand daily. Tracksuit is fast becoming the common language for marketers and agencies to measure, understand, and communicate the value of brand building. Check them out at gotracksuit.com. That's gotracksuit.com. Now back to the show. So Heather, Land O'Lakes, working, I'm not sure if you're still working with them, but you did work with the Martin Agency, did some terrific work, CIO, which is a great spot. There's also a lot of work coming out of that effort. Is how important is the marketing in terms of generating demand? Is that seen as something that you have to invest in increasingly more, or what's the reality of that from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm probably in the same boat as every other CMO, which is proving out the value of marketing, right? I don't know that we were always a brand forward company. So it's really important that we're working to educate the organization and being very focused ourselves and accountable on driving growth. So that's an ongoing effort, I would say. We have to be smart with our marketing communications. We're not in the big CPG land budgets. We just make sure that we have agencies that can work with us to bring really big ideas that we can, that are culturally relevant, that we can push out, that get a bigger sort of punch above their weight, if you will. Martin Agency did some absolutely fantastic work for us on the Dairy Foods Business, a CIO campaign that you mentioned, which was really about highlighting, you know, every farmer isn't a white gentleman with blue overalls in front of a red barn. There's actually a lot of women who are farmers, and many cases, families are on the farm, so the women are a really big part of that. So that was really celebrated. And they also did some tremendous work for us in the animal nutrition space. A beautiful campaign, both of which were before my time, so I cannot take credit for those. And they were a fantastic partner for us. We no longer work with Martin, but not for any reason other than I felt like the work that they wanted to do was probably bigger than our ambitions were for the work. And so we mutually parted ways, and we have now some incredible agency partners we're very fortunate to work with. Battery out of LA, who developed our Eat It Like You Own It campaign that is working extremely well and is helping us, to be honest with you, as a organization within Land O'Lakes to show the performance and how marketing can actually shift sales. And then we have an agency we've been working with on our enterprise business, and they're also working in animal nutrition right now, called Human Design out of Colorado, which are a very unique kind of agency, I would say. So I'm a big fan of casting agencies that I think are going to be the best fit. So I think we're in the life stage we are now as a marketing organization. These agencies really are tremendous partners for us. So marketing communications is really in all parts of our business, regardless of whether it's B2B or B2C, is a really important part of driving our growth.
You're bringing up a topic that so many marketers struggle with, which is convincing either their organization or their CFO, the C-suite, about the benefit and the need to invest in brand. Is there one or two examples of how you might have done that? I know it's probably not a completed journey, but...
Yeah.
Because you were typically a very quiet brand until, at least I hadn't seen much until a couple of years ago. Then it suddenly came on strong and has quietened down a bit, I think, more recently. But tell us about the journey.
Yeah, so I'm glad that you're seeing it over the last couple of years, because I can take credit for that with my team. But I think so. It starts for me. I was very fortunate, because it was one of the first questions I asked in the interview that I had with our incredible CEO Beth Ford, was, "Do you believe in the power of brands?" And she absolutely does. And so that was my starting point. I don't know that everybody else in the company at the C-suite level was there. So I've spent time over the last three and a half years of really helping people understand how marketing can be a lever for growth. And I have a wonderful team of peers that I work with who are just sponges for information. So it's not that they're against, they just really need to try and I need to help them understand, where to leverage us. The relationships have been really critical for me and helpful for me of being with the CFO, which is, you would think. And our CFO and I have had great conversations. And I think part of it has been being very transparent and open with them on things that have not worked, so that it's not all sunshine and rainbows and we all are good news, but being really transparent with him, and also just speaking in his language, so that we can make sure that what we're saying really translates well, and they can, we're building empathy across the group. And that's with his entire group. Our finance organization are really quite incredible. They've helped me on a number of different projects. So I've built that strong relationship with finance, but equally with our COO, with the heads of the business units. So it's a constant part of my job every day to remind people about marketing and the role that we can have, and then showcasing, the metrics, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that, I think, has helped build some trust.
And CIO that spot, and there was a ton of buzz around that. Did that demonstrate returns that you were able to leverage internally? And was there recognition that that type of an initiative had a substantive return?
So I would say, in terms of what I would actually say is, I think, yes, everybody, still references that campaign too. So it definitely had a really big effect. I don't know that we put metrics behind it to showcase that. Where we are now, we have really strong marketing attribution models, which, by the way, we've had endorsed by our finance department, because that helps bring more credibility to it as well. So we're now in a position where we're able to show the lift in the brand, the lift in sales. We have all those metrics in place. I wish we'd had it in place at the time CIO was out, because I think it would have been an even more compelling story to tell. Although, as I said, it's one of those campaigns that will be forever remembered, and we still bring that work out occasionally. So it's a powerful story to tell.
Kate, what about brand for Domino's? Because I think about Domino's as really being very transaction-oriented in its communications, but I think that's changed recently, where it almost feels like everything is branded performance rather than just performance.
Well, it's a big compliment to hear you have observed that. I think that is 100% our goal. I mean, it is performance at the end of the day. You want to make the CFO happy to the last conversation, drive orders and sales profitably, but that can be very short term. And I think I'm really excited, inspired, all the words like that, just because we took the time in the last year to do the work to figure out what's happening with the industry and consumers and where we need to double down. And it is 100% driven by a bigger focus on brand. But I think the beautiful thing is not at the expense of driving performance and sales.
So Stephanie, one of the, and just in general here, one of the big things that can hurt mature brands is that there's this perception that big brands can't react or can't be proactive. They become reactive. Not all of them are that way, but that's a tendency. So they can get hit unexpectedly from new entrants into the category. And spirits is a big category where that happens. And, you know, and Tito's came in and came out of nowhere and did something that arguably Smirnoff couldn't do. They couldn't do it the way that Tito's did it, but it is now, I think, the largest vodka brand in the U.S. out of Austin, Texas, with what they label as American vodka, right? I think they call it American vodka. How do you sort of, then you have to react to that, or do you? I mean, so I'm just trying to understand, is growth a reaction to some of the things that happen in the marketplace when you're the big mature dog in the category?
Yeah, I mean, and I will just say that, yes, Tito's is the biggest vodka brand in the U.S., but Smirnoff is more than double their size globally. So, and that's just our vodka business. However, to your point, I think what big brands can do really well, which is what we at Smirnoff, I think, in more recent years have really challenged ourselves to do, is what we do well is we're never going to be the first, right? And we probably shouldn't be the first necessarily in new spaces or new flavors or new offerings. However, but what we do really well is we spot trends and we figure out which trends are going to go to scale. And that is our job. Like, that is our focus area. So it's not about being a first mover on a lot of things. It's about being a fast follower to lead to scale. So actually using the fact that the industry is so exciting and so dynamic, and there's all kinds of little brands popping up and doing interesting things that we're getting to see consumers react to. And I think where we are focusing on Smirnoff, which is a newer focus, I will say getting maybe back to this focus on Smirnoff, is spotting those trends as they start to demonstrate that they have scale potential, and then being the brand that takes it there.
Switching to a different topic, I wanted to, Heather, ask you about your marketing spend, the mix. Not as much seems to be spent as much on advertising, paid advertising, as it might be now spent in different areas. Looking at where things are today for you guys and what you're seeing in the industry, what do you think is changing about how money is being spent?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And I think we mentioned some of this before. I get a little bit concerned because as a marketing industry, we love shiny objects. So I feel like we have swung the pendulum so far into performance marketing that we've missed, I think Kate mentioned this earlier, we've missed the brand building piece. And so we try in Land O'Lakes, and we did this at Harley, we probably lean much more into the brand building side, but everything has to perform. So I always think the performance marketing title is a bit of a misnomer. So for us, you know, we've got a collection of businesses that I mentioned before and brands also that are really, I would say, incredibly powerful within the niche industries they serve. So if you think about the addressable market, for example, for Horseseed, there's only so many horses in the company. So meaningful depth of connection with audiences and media partners really takes precedent for us over reach numbers. So we're investing more in building community and human relationships because we believe in that space, there's much less opportunity for waste. So thinking about, yes, influencers, but influencers have a real connection with the category that we're in. And a group that we're calling change makers, which are essentially that young emerging audience of Gen Z who we believe can help us get our message out around the importance of rural America and how people think about food and rural urban divide. So it's really about building those authentic community relationships and paid media, you know, again, somebody mentioned earlier about inflationary pressures. I mean, the costs in media have gone up so far. So we are in a position where we're, you know, we practice dynamic budgets. So we're using our media budgets, particularly paid social, as sort of fluid and flexible. So where we see people starting to respond, and we actually did this at Harley too, we put something online first, see how people are responding. And if they did, then we pick it up and scale it. But we very much were in that mode and certainly similar to us with Land O'Lakes. So we have good investment in our brands, but it tends to be in more in the digital space, I would say, and more in building community than big, broad paid advertising.
Is it building community with the goal of that then achieving reach through that influential communities?
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, as I said, like if we take the horse of the equine industry, if we reach the right people and they build their community, then we build reach through that, as opposed to us having to do it all ourselves.
How about for you, Kate? What is the mix like for you in terms of what you're doing in communications and channel spend?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the highest level, we have always and we will always continue to follow consumption. So you just have to be where your audiences are. And certainly, we already talked a little bit about the power and value of unexpected actions that lead to earned media and PR. So that's an important part of our mix. But, you know, broad-based advertising and marketing works. And frankly, it is more cost effective, you know, cost per point. When you get really, really segmented, you're paying more. So when you're a brand as big as we are, broad-based media certainly works. I think the two areas that get really interesting and have shifted so much in the last few years is just the creator economy and influencers and how to do that in a way that makes sense, is relevant, and is authentic and really authentic to your brand, and find creators that really love Domino's tend to do that the best. And then I think partnerships. I think that is not something Domino's has historically done a tremendous amount of work, but when you're a bigger brand, you're more mature, and there's other brands that have, there's just that mutual benefit of sharing your equity and what can neither of us do on our own that only we can do together. I think that's a huge unlock that we're looking to take advantage more of in the future.
And are you comfortable? I've brought this up a number of times in recent episodes. A senior marketer mentioned to me that there was some anxiety within their ranks about giving themselves over to influencers because they were concerned that the message and the way they want it to be expressed would either be diluted or ignored by the influencer. Is that a concern that you might have, or have you found a way to control for that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in marketing for so long that is a normal thing to be scared of from, you know, how we grew up and how we were taught. But I frankly think that you got to lean in. If you want to win with Gen Z, what's going to be relevant? And we always talk about, so it's a little unhinged, the kind of content that speaks to that audience. You have to be willing to let go to some degree. And I think, but while also knowing and making sure that, you know, your higher level strategy is coming through, but it is not an easy thing to let go of that control. But I think you have to make work that resonates.
So Stephanie, with you, how about your marketing mix and your tactical mix? Has it shifted recently? And can you share about that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just sitting here nodding because I just agree with so much of everything that Heather and Kate are both saying about, you know, I think what Heather said about balancing the long-term brand building with the short-term performance is something we are actively talking to our markets about, because like in my role, I sit globally. So it's about working with the markets and making sure that their media buys are being optimized in the right way based on what the brand needs. And we've certainly seen much more of a focus on that short-term marketing and not enough on that long-term. And so I think readjusting to get that balance right so that we get the cumulative benefit of that long-term brand building over time is so critical. And then what Kate said about you know, these fandom communities and influencers and being able to tap into these fandoms in a way that is focused and very targeted. But then if you do it right and, you know, you do it well, it then becomes a platform that reaches the masses, but it does it in a really authentic, incredible way coming from these communities. So I think that's something that, if I'm honest, we're starting to do more of, and we're navigating that. We're navigating how we engage influencers in more meaningful ways to create that authenticity. But it is definitely critical to the future of the brand and driving that relevance. And I think it is the thing that is changing the game the most right now for senior marketers is navigating that landscape.
You guys have mentioned a few things during the conversation about this, which is the marketing sciences. I think it was Heather that touched on attribution structure and attribution models that you now have in place. I'm curious for the group here, how do you feel about the marketing sciences? Because there's a big debate going on in certain circles about the degree to which American marketers have adopted effectiveness measures and the whole sort of definition of marketing sciences. This is Byron Sharp, Bennett and Field. There's a few folks here in the U.S., but not a lot that are helping with it. What are your thoughts about that? Are you using some of those principles in your business? And, you know, are you doing marketing mix modeling in your comms strategies and in your spend? Is it a day-to-day reality, or is it something that you're beginning to adopt? I don't know whomever would like to start with that.
So when I was on the agency side, Mars for my client, so I got to know Byron Sharp very well because they really followed his principles very tightly. And I think there are elements of what Byron and Ember Bass talk about, and it's, you know, proven out with their sciences about distinctiveness, for example. So we talk a lot about that with our brand. So it's not just differentiation. You have to get to the point of distinctiveness so you build those memory structures in people's minds. So I think I take a little bit of Byron Sharp's methodology and I understand some of it. There's a lot of it I don't necessarily agree with in terms of my practice. I'm more of a fan of Les Vinet. And Les was, full disclosure, I was at DEV. Les was at DEV as well. But his long and the short of it does that. Those case studies are really about a balance of longer term brand building and while making sure you're performing in the short term. So the mix of both. And so I think about, you know, focusing our measurement on our attribution models and marketing mix models, but then from a principal standpoint, so more following hopefully Les's principles than Byron's.
How about you, Kate or Stephanie, whomever would like to jump in?
I mean, I can just say Diageo definitely subscribes to Byron Sharp's principles. I think distinctivity, as you heard me talk about, is very much the North Star that we're solving for on Smirnoff. And then I think this idea of always be recruiting light briars, you know, in terms of how brands grow, like that definitely informs our marketing strategies and how we measure success. But I agree with Heather. I think in terms of the Les Binet, the importance of that long-term brand building and the emotional connection, what brands stand for, the role of purpose, I really believe in, both for consumers, but also perhaps most importantly for the employees in the business. And I think to what Kate said earlier about it serves such an important North Star that guides what the brand does in bigger, more exciting, culturally relevant ways. So
anything to wrap up, Kate?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's a lot to debate among these philosophies, but from a Byron Sharp perspective, we believe and see the power of distinctiveness for your brand. And really, you know, I got trained at Procter & Gamble and A.G. Lafley, and consumer as boss will always be, you know, my North Star and truth. And I think doing the work to understand what your brand stands for and what you want, who you want to win with and how you need to be distinctive is critical. But you pair that with the power of data, because between media mix model and A/B testing and real world testing that we're able to do as an e-commerce business, I think the power is in bringing all of that together to create, you know, strategic marketers that have the intuition and instinct to keep pushing forward and taking more risk in terms of where we where we decide to take the brand. So, you know, I think there's value in all of those areas. And I do think data continues to be hugely powerful, not only for shaping the future, but for bringing your stakeholders along. We were talking about the CFO or the franchisees. All of that's critical to keep moving the brand forward.
It is Kate Trumbull. She is Chief Brand Officer at Domino's Pizza, Stephanie Jacoby's Global SVP, Smirnoff at Diageo, and Heather Malinchek is SVP and CMO at Lando Lakes. Thank you all so much for being a part of this final episode in this series. It's been a great conversation. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice being with you all.
And we will see everyone on the next episode.